Hey everybody, welcome to the fourth Tai Chum Bucket podcast. I'm Robin Smith and my co-host is Justin Ritchie. Hey Justin, what you been up to?
Yeah, I've been looking out my window at all of the mountains as they've been obscured by the smoke particulates from Siberia this week, and it's been really great. I've had a great time.
So how's that happen? There was what, a forest fire in Russia and somehow that blew.
It just blew over.
Well, we have a good show today.
We're going to be speaking to somebody who is helping her community get prepared for emergencies.
And then we're going to talk to Ariel, one of the Tai's All-Star interns from the summer. She did a brief stint with us. So we'll talk to her briefly about that and also hear a bit of behind the scenes from her recent story on the UN rapporteur on adequate housing who visited Vancouver this week.
Yeah, how does Vancouver stack up against other places with housing problems? That's what we're going to find out.
Well, let's get started. So last week we met with Anne and she was generous enough to give us a tour of her home. But first we talked about why she's preparing for the next big emergency, big natural disaster in British Columbia. So, Anne, you're a chemical engineer. At what point in your career did you start being interested in emergency preparedness?
I grew up in California, so to a certain extent, I was aware of the need to be prepared. But I think really emergency preparedness in the way I'm looking at it right now is a way to build community resilience. We ran across a similar project in Port Townsend in Washington State, which just had some amazing results in terms of being able to forge bonds within the community and also between the community and the emergency social services or the emergency services. And I think given the increasingly obvious series of disasters that we're experiencing, that it's really becoming obvious to people around the need to prepare. So it catches people, it draws people's attention. It's an easy way to establish a relationship. So in terms of the work I'm doing now, it's really an excellent tool to gain access to people.
So what kind of emergencies are you talking about when you say emergency preparedness?
It's a whole range of emergencies. When you're prepared for an emergency, you're really prepared for a number. I mean, each one has different characteristics, so they might have slightly different things that you would be needing to, like a hurricane is different than an earthquake, for example, and it's different than, let's say, an oil embargo where we all of a sudden don't have access to imported goods. But in a way, just being part of it is the preparation where you have physical goods. Part of it is a personal preparation where you actually increase your training levels. And that has impacts, both of them, to your psychological preparation and your ability to really cope with circumstances which may not be in your ordinary. So I think all of those work together and they each build off of each other.
So I think a lot of people in British Columbia talk about the big one. That's right. That's sort of the big BC event that we all fear. What kind of physical and personal preparation have you done, for example, for an earthquake?
Well, on a personal level, we've done a lot of work around the house, identifying the hazards that we've got in the house. And we're probably about 70% there. I mean, there's still some things that I'd like to tie down to the walls and Velcro down some of our, we've got a lot of knickknacks still way too high up. But so there's looking around your house, identifying what hazards you've got. There is getting your stores ready so that in the event that you are cut off from supplies from the outside, you've got enough to tide you through that period. And the typical, the city says 72 hours, but in fact, what's more likely to happen is really you're talking weeks, if not months, before you really can get back up on your feet again, at least in the context of an earthquake the size of what they're talking about here, which is called a megathrust earthquake. It's a 9. It's like what hit Japan last year, and it would decimate a large part of the coast, potentially, you know, several hundred kilometers up and down the coast, which would really have a knock-on effects, which are bigger than what you think. So, stores of food, stores of water, emergency shelter, clothes. Just in the immediate aftermath, you want to be prepared to handle the broken glass, to be able to shut off your gas, to be able to shut off your water so that you can maintain your water sources inside the house. So there's that piece, you know, having mm-hmm. a sturdy pair of boots underneath your bed or shoes and a hard hat and gloves, because you're really, one of the biggest injuries right afterwards is just walking on broken glass. It tends to shatter pretty easily. So there's that piece as well. And then there's what, which is what I'm really working on now, which is working with my neighbors. So on a block by block basis, and in particular this block, we had our first block meeting about 2 weeks ago, where we invited all 24 houses, and we had about 12 come, which was fantastic. And people gathered in my living room, and we went through the program that we've decided to adopt, and we all talked about it, and there was an incredible energy there. It was really fantastic. Mm-hmm. I mean, people really appreciated the effort of organizing it, but they also appreciated just getting to know their neighbors.
Did you know them before, or did they know each other before?
Not really. In fact, one neighbor said they lived here for 4 years, and they met more people in that one evening than they'd met the whole time they'd lived here. And mm-hmm. and that's certainly the case, my case. You know, I've seen people and said hello, you know, but that's no deeper than that. So mm-hmm. we actually had an opportunity to talk through some of these issues, and I think everybody recognized the value of that.
You teach a class at Langara College about this, and so you get a lot of people who are interested in learning more, but do you find that there are people in the community who are really thinking about how to be emergency prepared, or does this really come up on people as something they've never really thought about before?
There's actually a significant number of people who have thought about it before and who are prepared, just wandering the neighborhoods and talking, you know, walking the neighborhoods and talking to people, but the majority know or not. The city runs courses regularly here. They run them throughout the community centers. Here they've been running, you know, every other month they run a program, and sometimes they get 15 people, sometimes they get 30 people. And they teach a very basic personal level preparedness. And we're woefully unprepared as a city. And Canada in general is woefully unprepared. I think the United States has been beaten up quite a bit more regularly recently, so there's an increasing level of awareness there. In fact, the program we've decided to adapt here is called Map Your Neighborhood, and it was developed in Washington State, and they won awards for it. They've implemented it in a number of communities that have already gone through earthquakes, so they've been able to test the success of it. It's a great program.
Hmm. How often do you think about an emergency happening? Is it on your mind a lot? Does it weigh on you?
In different ways. I'm, you know, being part of the transition initiative, I spend a lot of thought around the whole issue of our economic instability tied in with the climate change, tied in with peak oil. And I tend to read a lot, and I tend to read some stuff that's pretty scary. So I would say that about 80% of my, 70% of my waking hour, I always have something in my mind that, you know, which concerns me about where we are right now and how unstable this situation is. And, you know, when is it going to slide downhill? So not specifically about emergencies, but about the fact that we're, and to a certain extent, are living on borrowed time.
Mm-hmm. And that's sort of another side of what you prepare for is mm-hmm. sort of the transition. Can you tell us about that? What kind of preparation does that entail?
Well, transition is all about coming up with solutions that we want, developing, building a future we want. I started reading about climate change and peak oil back in 2004, and I can tell you the first couple of years were pretty grim. I'd get really depressed. So when transition came up, I first heard about it in 2007. I thought, okay, I can do this. You know, there's something I can do with this. And so when we moved to Vancouver in 2009, I looked up the transition movement here and got involved right away. So it still feels like we're not moving fast enough, and, you know, maybe we're not as direct as we can be in getting the message out there, but I still feel like it's, you know, there's a lot we're doing.
But what are you doing?
It's around food. It's around reskilling. So learning things that we used to know, our society used to know, as a matter of how to preserve food, for example. You know, how to take care of ourselves, not be so dependent upon being able to go out and buy something, assuming that we can always get what we need, but actually being able to produce it ourselves. So there's that. There's also the just in general the awareness raising. So just bringing more people into the understanding of how these three aspects, they're not individual items, but they actually interrelate quite close, tightly. And that if you don't understand all three of them together, you really aren't going to develop a solution that is going to work. So we work on that. We do, I don't know, movie nights, potlucks, permaculture. Permaculture is a big thing. So the whole food thing seems to dominate here. We do a lot around food.
Mm-hmm. Did you move here from South America?
Yes.
And what about your time there that really turned you on to these issues or got you thinking about emergency preparedness once you arrived in Vancouver?
I guess in a way it's really interesting when you know, people think about Latin America as being undeveloped and really poverty-stricken and being unable to survive, being on a survival mode. But in a way, I think they're going to have a lot easier time when things break down because they, in fact, already live that way. Whereas I think the resilience level here is really very low. It's a society that's highly dependent upon kind of the fluid movement of goods and money and services and things like that. So people aren't really able to take care of themselves. And the population density relative to the resources is really skewed as well. This place cannot sustain the number of people that live here. So, you know, in a way, it's actually really, I'd want to be down there.
Yeah. What skills would the ideal sort of transition savvy person have? What personal skills?
Individual skills depend upon the passion and the interest of the individual. I mean, really, you need people of all different colors, all different walks of life, all different bents, all different mindsets. I think in order to be survivors, and they do talk about survivors in this whole thing, it's that ability to not be bogged down in the detail. It's always to have that drive forward, that drive to survive. So, you know, if you dwell on the negatives, you're not going to make it. You know, you really do need to be able to put aside. You can have a moment of, oh my gosh, but you know, once that happens, then you kind of put it aside and you move on, and you exercise creativity. You exercise a sense of confidence and moving forward. And I think, you know, those are kind of the universal things that make people successful. Mm-hmm. But you can have doctors, you can have carpenters, you can have gardeners, you can have, you know. And you trade, mm-hmm. you know, you just have to be flexible,
mm-hmm. right?
And be willing to look beyond the negatives and the limitations and go to where, you know, what you've got, really what you can count on.
If you talk about systemic breakdown or the potential for systemic breakdown to somebody, do they really just shut off and turn off because it's like bums them out so much? Or have you found ways to engage people when talking about these issues?
Sometimes you just back off and you don't talk about it too much. I mean, you can kind of see them glazing over. So you have to gauge it depending upon how the conversation is going. And oftentimes you don't really talk directly about it. It really is context driven.
Was that your daughter? What kind of conversations do you have with your daughter about transition or peak oil, kind of those scary concepts? Do you talk about it or is it?
Some. I mean, you'd be surprised. I read her books now. You'd be surprised at the predominance of dystopian literature in the young adult. I mean, basically all the books that she's reading are about a world that is not like this one, mm-hmm. post-apocalyptic. The difference between kind of where I mean, I used to love science fiction when I was her age, but we never had strong girl characters. I mean, these books, the girls rock. I mean, they are so tough and so capable. It's great. Mm-hmm. So that's a good thing.
Kind of like, is it the Hunger Games? Is
that that's a good example.
Yeah, The Giver. That kind of thing.
So what are preppers and what are they doing to deal with these issues? Or
there's a whole range of preppers. There's those that go out and buy their guns and think about going off into the wilderness and just having, you know, being in an isolated place and, you know, kind of guarding their own. And then there's, you know, more into the middle where I think we are, which is, you know, no man is an island. You can't do it on your own. So really, if you can build that community before something bad happens, then you can count on them. And you're much stronger, much more capable of really thriving, not just surviving, but actually getting back up on your feet again and going forward more quickly. So it goes from the whole range.
So can you give us a bit of a tour of some of the things that you've done to be emergency prepared here at your house?
Food. I relearned how to can. My mom used to can with me. So done a lot of canning. I have chickens. I have both chickens here at home, and I have 120 chickens, laying chickens over on our farm. So I've learned how to work with animals. I wanted to get some livestock experience. So I sell eggs. I've slaughtered chickens. I've plucked and gutted and so done that.
As well as how did the neighbors respond?
I try and keep it so they don't see that bit of it. And I did think that my daughter it would be good for her to experience that. And it took her a year before she'd eat chicken again. She's just started eating chicken again. It's a little bit too fast on that one, maybe. Yeah. I took a first aid course. And I want to take more. In fact, I'd really like to take a wilderness first aid course, which doesn't assume you've got 911 to back you up. I'm doing the preparation, the emergency preparation I'm learning at the same time that I'm teaching. But, you know, that's part of it as well. I'm learning about organizing at the community level, you know, kind of neighbor to neighbor, which I never learned before. None of my professional training had ever brought me to that. I have bought some kit that I haven't actually put together, like the solar panel recharging into a, you know, a big generator kind of battery. I haven't figured that one out yet. I have to hook it up. I want to take I'm signing up for an amateur radio course in the fall. I have become a volunteer for the emergency social services, so I can actually start going out to disasters as a volunteer, and helping out.
I'm especially interested in the chicken slaughtering.
It's not bad, actually.
No.
Well, the plucking's pretty disgusting.
How did you learn to do it? Did you just, you know, watch YouTube?
Yeah.
Oh, no, that poor first chicken.
And a woman I took a permaculture course with, we decided to do it together. So we helped each other out. I think I held down the chicken and she chopped its head off the first time.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
And that's just like a little hangout.
Well, we try it for a nesting box, but they don't actually like it for a nesting box.
Right. How many eggs do you get a day?
Three maybe in the summer, yeah. Something like that. So they lay three a week, four a week, each one.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, and we get some, one of them lays, actually two of them lay green eggs.
Oh, cool.
So you get an omelet every day?
Yeah, you could pretty much, yeah. We share with another family.
Oh.
So, but yeah, those birds, we could get that many.
So it's exciting, really going in there. It's like getting mail.
Yeah. This is the first time you've ever had chickens?
Yeah, I've had them now for a year and a half.
What was it like when you first got them back and started learning about them?
Well, it's not that difficult, really. It's really not that difficult. And we got them in the very beginning, so there weren't a lot of people around that had knowledge. But, you know, we've had some issues.
Yeah. And no complaints from neighbors?
No, not too much. I mean, we've had... we did have some problems with raccoons that got a couple of our chicks last year and unfortunately took the bodies over to the next-door neighbors and deposited them on the porch, and they have two small boys, so he wasn't very happy about that.
Comes with the territory. He'll be happy when
I took him some couple dozen eggs.
And so what is this that's protecting all these hands?
I ended up using just the webbing that you get from MEC. So I went down to MEC. We were trying to figure out what the best way to do it. And so we used a staple gun and then two bands of, 2-inch webbing to hold back, you know, pretty much everything.
And so in the event of an earthquake, the cans would run up against it.
And then stop. That's right. So jars, cans, they're not going to end up on the floor.
How do you decide what to put here? Like,
it's really personal. Mm-hmm. You don't store something you're not going to eat.
Right.
So you really want to store what you eat and eat what you store or something like that. And you want to make sure that you rotate it. You don't want to leave it here for too long. Mm-hmm.
So it's more like an extended pantry. You're always coming down here and eating things?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. So this is part of it. I've got, you know, pastas and All sorts of different beans and grain pulses, extra sugars and olive oils, and that's also more flours, and then some beans down below and large sugar. Vinegar is really good. It's multi-purpose. You can use it for cleaning, disinfecting.
There's a lot of maple syrup.
I know, my daughter loves pancakes. And she puts a lot of maple syrup.
So if there's an earthquake, you're ready for pancakes.
I'm ready for
post-earthquake pancakes. So Robin, what did you find out about getting emergency prepared that you were not prepared for?
Well, I'm pretty much not prepared at all. I don't have a grab and go bag. I haven't locked down all of my canned goods in a, you know, earthquake proof place. I don't have a huge stash of maple syrup. I don't know how to kill a chicken. So I literally have done nothing. I guess my only advantage is that I, you know, have grown a few plots of lemon balm and mustard greens.
Lemon balm. That's what's going to get you through the earthquake.
I know. I mean, I've come so far just by talking to Anne, and my first step is to get out my tent and get it in an easily accessible place.
So you're inspired to take action is what you're saying.
Yeah, I was totally inspired by Anne. The Tahi had a great intern the past few months. Ariel Fournier was with us, and her last piece for us was about an interview with the UN Special Rapporteur on Adequate Housing, who came to Vancouver, has come a number of times, and has made several recommendations in previous years. And this most recent visit, she asked him how we'd been doing, had we met the targets that he set out for us years ago, and generally gave us an update. So, Ariel, you recently interviewed the UN Rapporteur, Special Rapporteur on Housing, I believe. Is that correct?
On Adequate Housing.
On Adequate Housing.
Yeah.
More important than housing. And so, like, how did you meet him and what was that like? What did you talk about?
So, we actually, it was suggested to me that we meet up because he was going on a tour of the Downtown East Side neighborhood and meeting with the staff at First United to talk to them, and also just to see, because he was here before on a fact-finding mission in 2007. So he was going through the neighborhood to see if he, to get an impression of how things have changed, because he had advised the city and housing bodies at the time, and so he was coming back to meet with them again and also get a bit of a sense of how things have changed. So we walked along Hastings. We took him to the DNC market, which he seemed to love. We also went by the Carnegie, which had a Guru Nanak's kitchen.
Oh, what's that?
Which is the Sikh temple, I guess, gives one of the Sikh temples gives out free meals about once a month. So we just happened to be passing by. He commented on the fact that he was surprised to see all these old Sikh men wandering around, and so that was sort of interesting. He's from New Delhi, and then we made our way over to, it also happened to be the day that Libby Davies' family barbecue in McLean Park was happening, so that's where we finally ended up, and then we sat down and chatted with various activists from around the neighborhood, and then we had a seat, and then we sat down for this interview.
The process of gentrification seems to have rapidly increased, as has the you know, speculation of housing. So there hasn't been much change, and I understand that there's a task force that's been set up to look at the issue of affordability, but they're not really dealing with the affordability question for people below a certain income, 21,000 a year or something. So I don't see much change for the better. I think what you see in Canada and what you've seen in the United States for a very long time is essentially that housing is treated as a commodity. It's treated as something you buy and sell rather than as a social good. And for a lot of people, it's something that they need, right? You cannot survive without housing. And if it's treated as a social good, then the whole thinking would change. And if you only treat it as something that is out there in the market, not everybody can engage. I think there has to be a legislative change in Canada. I mean, the housing is still not recognized as a human right. There needs to be charter challenges. There is a case going on in the Ontario, the case that's beginning in the Ontario Superior Court on the right to housing. So there has to be legal change. There's the bill that has been introduced by, that was previously introduced by Libby Davis. I think it's been reintroduced again. So there has to be that. There also has to be more pressure to hold Canada accountable to its international obligations. So I think more work has to be done to ensure that relevant UN bodies have the information that is about the situation here. The other would be that I just feel that there has to be much more sort of civil society activism at different levels, local, provincial, and federal levels, to raise awareness that housing is a right. It's essentially the housing continuum idea which has come out of Canada, where you have housing policies that ensure that there are shelters, there's supported housings, there's hostels, there's rental housing, and then there's ownership housing. So you have the possibility that people can move according to their own, you know, capacity and change, move from one option to another. What's been mostly happening, and you can see this in Vancouver, is that you only have 2-3 choices, right? You have either shelters, or you have rental housing, or you have ownership housing, and there's been a big push to ownership housing. So it creates a huge gap in the social sort of housing area. So that a direct result of that is that you have more people who are homeless, or more people who are doubling or tripling up. You have more people who are living in a precarious housing situation because they don't have an option. So the question I always have for municipalities, for governments, is why in your housing policy or your conception or your planning, why do you not have this concept of the housing continuum, and why is it that people are, you know, left essentially to look after themselves?
So what was it like talking to somebody who is a true outsider to the Vancouver housing market, who's used to completely different housing conditions in their own country of India, and then seeing it through their perspective? What kind of insights does it provide to people who live in this city?
It's easy to forget when you're living here what the pace of change is, but that these problems are still exactly as they were before 4, 5, 7 years ago. So I think that I really appreciated that, and I think that it was very interesting having someone who had concrete solutions and who actually was saying, we just need to get it done. So there was a little bit of hope to it in terms of there are alternatives out there, but they're not happening. So it was pretty bittersweet, but it was very, very interesting.
So what are you doing next after your internship's over? Today, actually. It's over today.
Yeah, it is over today. After this, I will be... So I have another job as a casual, for full disclosure. So I was already working in media before I started, and I wanted to do more writing. So I think my internship probably was a bit of a different experience because I had been working in media for a little bit. So my experience is actually usually in radio. And so I'm going back to that. So I'll be working on a concert series after this.
Very cool.
For the summer.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks so much, Ariel.
Thank you.
So that wraps up our show for today, speaking with Anne and Ariel about emergency preparedness and housing crisis. Mm-hmm. And so the Tai Chum bucket comes at you at irregular intervals. You never know when you're going to reach into your iTunes and find a Chum bucket, which is probably a good thing, because if you were expecting it, you'd shy away from it. Mm. So, yeah, Robin. So what's going on at the Tai that our listeners and readers should know about?
Well, we're kind of entering the dog days of summer, which is a great time at the Tai because that's when we put our heads together and we start thinking about what crazy things we can do for the year to come, starting in September. So I can't tell you much about what special projects we have coming up, but they're just going to blow you away. I mean,
really? They're that good?
Last year we saw, you know, a number of great series. We had some fantastic reporting, huge stories, and you know, we're only getting bigger and better at the Tai with the Builder program and with, you know, all of the support we've been getting from Tai readers.
So that wraps up our Tai Chum Bucket for this week. We will catch you on the next episode.